Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now, Season 3. Today I'm talking with actor Danny Woodburn. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Keith. Thanks for having me.
You get starred on Seinfeld back in the day, but is that how you got your start in acting?
No, I studied at Temple University School of Communications and Theater. I flipped back and forth between what they called then RTF, which meant radio, television, and film. Those were the mediums, and the theater department. So I indirectly dual majored because I kept changing my major every year and a half. I ended up completing my degree in radio, television, and film with a lot of extracurricular activities in the theater department, including at least 4 plays that I can recall offhand. Yeah. While I was there, and some of those plays toured to community theater. One show that we did, a musical that we did, it went to New York, the Chekhov stages. And then I went to New York to do a play right after college. And then I taught at like a summer program for like inner city kids, African-American focused school called the Freedom Theater. I taught for a summer for those kids. It was like a summer, you know, summer theater school for young kids. And my kids, I had 20 kids between 8 and 10, which was it's like herding cats. That many kids at that particular age, because it's all about trial and testing. So that helped break me in for pounding the pavement in Los Angeles. So after that summer, I moved to L.A.
Take us back to when you first got the call to audition for Seinfeld, and then when you actually got cast.
So I didn't know much. Honestly, I didn't know much about the show. I didn't really watch the show at the time. So my audition was at the end of 1993. Yeah. Sometime in the fall of 93, I guess it would have been December of that year. And I went to a casting assistant named Brian Myers, who's now a casting director. And then from there, moved up to the casting director. And then from there, moved on to casting in front of the casting director and producers, who basically was Jerry and Larry. So it was me, Jerry and Larry, and Mark Hirschfeld, the casting director of the show, in that room on that fateful day. So that was my callback. After 3 auditions, that was my callback. And I pretty much went right from the audition to work. So I had a few others there competing with me on the day, but I was the one lucky enough to get the role.
So how was your first day on set?
The first day on a sitcom is basically it consists of a 4-camera shoot, so it consists of a table read in front of network and producers, and everybody sits around a table and reads the script pretty much cold, except I'd already auditioned, so I knew it fairly well at this point. And Michael Richards and I were across the table from each other doing our lines. And in that moment where we're supposed to fight in the script, I stood up on my side of the table. He stood up on his side of the table. And we kind of went for each other across the table. And then the whole room sort of broke up. So it was a very successful first day on the set. And really, all we did a little bit of blocking, I think, on that day. But mostly we just read the script, and then the writers will do rewrites and then come back. And, you know, you the next day you sort of really start your rehearsal the second day. So.
So before you got on the show, you said you didn't watch it, which, I mean, you had other work you were competing for. When did you get the sense that you were involved with something
Oh,
special, some
absolutely. Because already that show was the number one show on television. It was in there, the NBC, the big Thursday night lineup. It was the tent pole that sort of held up the whole tent on Thursday night. And it was already getting like 20, 22 million viewers a night. So yeah, we definitely knew then what you were in. You know, television today isn't the same. We don't really know who's watching what, or rather, the networks and studios don't want to tell us how successful their shows are. It keeps them from shelling out more money. Yeah, you knew then when you were on a hit show, you knew. You definitely knew. And it really hit me. My episode aired that February of 94. And I think that the day after it aired, I was driving my Toyota Tercel around LA, because actually my wife and I were looking for apartments, and somebody recognized me driving the car, which I thought, that's odd, because I'm not usually one you recognize in the car by face. I'm usually the one you recognize walking down the block, because you're like, I know that guy because of this package. But somebody recognized me in my car, and then the funny thing was, they were like, "Why are you driving a Tercel?" They right away assumed great success having booked this one show, so right away you have to sort of live up to this idea that you're a super successful actor, even though this was my first sitcom ever. I had done some episodics, I had done small parts in feature stuff, or I had been working on sound stages, but this was like my first super recognizable piece of work. And it was sort of instant fame. You know, I remember a cop was going to give me a ticket because we were looking for apartments, and I was parked in a red zone, and the cop came up to the side of the window, and I said, "Oh, this is my fiance then. My girlfriend's inside. She's looking at an apartment. I was just waiting for her." And he was about to write me a ticket, but then he just sort of stumbled over his words and went, "You're not, you gotta, blah." And then he went, "Ah, just get out of here." And that was it, you know? So, like, okay, if I can get out of a parking ticket, then this means something.
So you just hit on something very important, the concept of instant fame. After your first sitcom role, how did you handle it? Were you prepared? Were you surprised? Of course, you
No, I
knew
was.
the show was something, but were you at all prepared?
Don't know if it's something you really prepare for. You start to sort of learn how to navigate fame after a while. It's part of the package of this business, right? If you're on TV and you're in movies and people recognize you, that sort of comes with the territory that people are going to engage with you. I think it's about how you handle yourself. If you give over everything to someone, then your time is not your own any longer. So you have to really make sure that you manage that. You know, this is my time, and this is the time that I have that I will share with you, and that should be enough. And I'm generally very gracious. But, sometimes people want to stop and talk with me when I'm trying to catch a plane, or, and it's like, I'd love to chat, but I have to go. I'm on my way to the theater. I'm on my way to meet someone. I'm on my way, I'm on a deadline, whatever. I think that's the only time I don't really engage. But otherwise, I'm happy to say hello and take a picture or whatever, or get out of a park ticket.
So, do you keep in contact with any of your fellow cat mates?
I do occasionally talk to Michael. I do occasionally talk to Jason. I ran into Jerry at a show, but he and I aren't we're not pen pals. we don't have a relationship like that. We go in different circles, as it
Yeah.
were. And so, and I think the last time I saw Julia was in was during the last writer's strike. We were on the picket lines together.
Yeah.
I seen Bryan Cranston, talk to him from time to time. Larry Thomas, the Soup Nazi, I talked to him time to time. Phil Morris, I was in contact. Phil Morris, who played Jackie Childs, I was in contact with Richard Hurd. We spoke fairly often. He was a nice gentleman. He just passed away, like maybe a year ago or a year and a half ago. Who else from this show? There's probably somebody else on the show that I do. Oh, Wayne. I talk to Wayne Knight from time to time as well. And Wayne and I just did a show together, actually. We just did a show called How to Be a Bookie.
Are you surprised at the enduring success and legacy of Seinfeld and its
You know, I think
impact on your career?
it's such a slice of pop culture. It's very much indicative of the 90s in every way. And so I think that's part of its enduring success. It was a unique style of show. As Jerry said, we'll never have a very special episode of Seinfeld, and he was right. There never was a very special episode. It wasn't it was a it was kind of a weird Friends hybrid, or a like a family show hybrid, but it's certainly not a family show, and it's certainly not Friends. And I think what is inherently different is that all of the characters are in some way irredeemable. They're reprehensible. They're characters that
Yeah, it's
you love
very
their
much.
idiosyncrasies, because we see a lot of our own bad qualities in them, and it gives us a chance to sort of laugh at ourselves in a way. So it's almost like therapy, I think, for some people, right? They get to watch other people do some of the things they wish they could do in the world. So it's sort of a venting release for people.
You touched on a very important point. The show was so 90s. Are you surprised or ever sick that people keep asking you, like I am, about this one role? I mean, I'm sure you've done tons of work. Much more redeemable than that one role,
Yeah,
but people keep coming back to this one role, like I am.
well, I think this is what people most recognize me for, this and every Christmas Jingle All the Way, which was not a big hit when it came out, but has turned into this enduring Christmas movie. Like, it was sort of released at the wrong time. It was a classic before it was supposed to be a classic. So Jingle All the Way is like another one of these kinds of films that people know me from. This is my first feature, my first studio film. So people know it because it plays every year, and it has a special place in people's hearts for the season. And of course, it's Schwarzenegger. So, people keep coming back to it because it was a different time. It was reflective of a different time. And I think that, despite Seinfeld's negativity, as it were, it is reflective of a different time that people are nostalgic for in a lot of ways.
Speaking of,
that's why it sticks. That's why it sticks in people's crawl, you know.
Speaking of a different time, you studied education and acting before the Americans with Disabilities Act came out in 1990.
Right.
How was that experience for you?
Well, I went to a you know, Temple University is a downtown campus. It's in North Philadelphia, and it's on Broad Street. So it's maybe like 5 blocks. Well, when I was there, it was like 5 blocks by 4 blocks. So they were pretty good sized blocks. So I would always have to schedule myself in a way where I wasn't crossing the whole campus, to go to a class. So I'd be like, well, if this is in the psych building, I definitely don't want to be back at the theater building right after that because it's a long walk. So maybe I'll pick something in humanities or stop at the library or something between that I can navigate that. And I also had a friend who was a poet, and he was studying English, I guess, and journalism. And I can't remember his name. He had CP, and he was a wheelchair user, and he was kind of an ass, because he would always insult me. And I would of course insult him back. But I think he felt like he had free rein to be this guy, to sort of this sort of jerky, quirky guy. But on the other end of it, I would tell him, I have a class all the way down in the psych building, and he would. I would stand on the back of his motorized chair, and he would shoot me all the way to the other side of campus. And so we were always quite a sight. But that was, we adapt, right? As people with disabilities, we try to adapt to our situations. We try to, like I said, I tried to schedule certain things in certain places, certain times of day. I knew that if I had to go to a building that didn't have an elevator, it might determine. It might determine how I schedule it. I certainly am not going to go up 4 or 5 flights of stairs to go to a class. That I would have never done. I did two things that happened to me in my schooling. Well, a couple of things. One, I did try to create my own adaption. So when I went to junior high in 77, 1977, my first year of junior high, I was in a body cast. I had just had hip surgery, and I was in a cast from my, just below my chest to my toes. It's called a hip spica. And September rolled around, and I wasn't getting out of this cast until November. So I didn't want to take school at home. So my mother took me. They bought a station wagon. They drove me to school. They rented a stretcher. They carried me up the front steps of the junior high, put me on the stretcher, and she demanded that the principal allow me to go to school on the stretcher. So I was wheeled around from class to class on the stretcher. But there was no elevator in this building, so I couldn't take a language class, and I couldn't go to math class, and I certainly didn't go to gym class. So during those periods, I was usually tucked away in the library, either doing homework or having my lunch or whatever. And my mother would usually come every day at lunchtime to make sure if I had to go to the bathroom, I could go, which was usually right there in the library. I would use the, a urinal or whatever. So that was one way in which pre-ADA, I was able to go to school. It's just about my mother advocating for me and the principal being cool with it and saying, let's try to work this out. And then in high school, I wasn't about to carry around in my backpack like 6 textbooks because, we like have to bring these books to class every day. So I said to every one of my teachers, I said, I need a book here in school and I need a book at home. So you have to sign out 2 books for me. And I was met with some resistance, but I said, look, I can't carry all these books from class to class and I'm not going to. So keep a book in the desk for me that I'm going to use. And they did. It was so the only book I ever had to carry around was my notebook, and that was it. So that was me advocating for myself. And that school had an elevator. And that school also had gym class where I could select the type of gym class I would be in. And I almost always chose swimming or archery, or we also had in my high school riflery. We had a shooting range at my high school dual place. And so that was me advocating for myself. And then college, I took an aptitude test and applied for a grant that was specifically for people with disabilities, I believe in the arts. And it was called the Charlotte Newcomb Fund, I guess. I don't know who this lady is. The fund doesn't exist anymore, but it probably paid for half of my school.
Wow. So getting back to Seinfeld, because we can't not talk about it, but not the show directly. You're an actor. This is the early to mid-90s. Did you see actors like yourself represented on the big or small screen? And I mean, you have to admit, in the early 90s, a sitcom casting someone
No,
with a Yeah.
I didn't see, I didn't really see, I could name the people with dwarfism that I knew in the business, which was Billy Barty, Michael Dunn, who had already passed away, Felix Stilla, who was Cousin It, and David Rappaport and Hervé Villechaize. I mean, that was it. Those were the guys who existed in my category. Everybody else was sort of on the periphery. Nobody had the kind of fame they all had. David Rappaport, having been in Time Bandits and having had his own series, The Wizard, which was on in the 80s, he killed himself. Hervé Villechaize killed himself. It made me think too that suicide was a prevalent factor in an actor with dwarfism's life. It didn't stop me, but it certainly gave me pause with regard to, I think, understanding depression and understanding, the struggles that exist in this business, how it's up and down, how it's, there's no guarantees, none of that. And I have absolutely myself gone through many ups and downs. It's a continuous roller coaster always. But I've been lucky enough to have a career now spanning 33 years. And I continue to work, I continue to get jobs. And I'm at this point in my life where I can use my advocacy, my fame to support advocacy measures for not only people like myself, people from all walks of disability, all areas of disability. I think in advocating for myself, and I became part of the Performers with Disabilities Committee at SAG, and then that was in the mid-90s, probably I began that process. And I worked with Robert David Hall, Dave, who was a committee chair for many, many years, decade, more than a decade. He was a staunch advocate for this movement, and it has since blossomed. I'd say only in the last 5 or 6 years has it blossomed into something that I think the industry is starting to take notice of, as far as disability on film and authenticity of the characters being portrayed by actors with disability. But I don't remember your question at this point. I just wanted to go down this path.
Yeah, No,
But yeah,
that's
it was about inspiration, and I think it was interesting to me because I didn't, while I enjoyed seeing Billy on screen, or I enjoyed watching Michael Dunn's performances in Wild Wild West, or even in Star Trek or Ship of Fools, other things that he'd been in, I didn't connect in the same way because their stories were very not often about their. They were human, yes, but there was also a pathos around them a lot of times that was written into the script regarding their size. And I don't feel like that's something I connected with. I actually connected more with, believe it or not, Sidney Poitier's struggle in his performances on screen. You know, this notion of being accepted as a man. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was very impactful to me, because it was about being recognized as a man. He's a person of color, obviously, in the 60s, at the height of the civil rights movement, where the shift is all but started. I felt that messaging to me was important. And so I latched onto him as kind of an inspiration more than people like myself in this arena, because they would tell stories too, I think, of judgment a lot of times, like in judgment and being ridiculed, which I certainly related to, but I didn't want that to be the entire story. So I felt like at the time these were important stories to tell around little people, but I just didn't want them to be the entire story. I didn't want it to have that be the story all the time. There was one story that Billy Barty was in that resonated with me. I really appreciated this storytelling. It was with he had a role on Little House on the Prairie, and there was as I recall, there was a child trapped in a well, and Billy, being as small as he was, but also being strong as a man, was able to be lowered down in the well and to grab the child and bring the child back up. And so I thought to myself, here is this man, as he was seen in these moments, using his differences to his advantage, where no one else could do what he did, you know. And I found that to be somewhat poignant to me. And I thought that's kind of the path I would like to be on, where I could show my differences and make them strengths. And that's what I feel like the disability community has to offer, that those differences can be seen as strengths and not weaknesses. Because I think a lot of time the pathos around the writing is about weakness, or, you know, you have all these tropes around disability on screen, the angry, bitter, disabled man, the blind person who longs to see, you know, these tropes of needing to be cured, or being angelic, or being superhuman, or being bitter. These are tropes that continue, and they're very one-dimensional. And I think that the goal in our community is to have us be seen more as human. And it goes back to my friend slash enemy with CP, who I went to school with. And I would see all the time, and he would trash talk, and I would trash talk him, and I wasn't a big fan, but I saw him for his whole person, you know. I saw him for who he was as a whole person. He was kind of a jerk. He was kind of a jerk, and that was unique, a perspective for someone in a wheelchair that, you know, you right away you don't assume, you know. You're like, oh, we got to give him a pass because he's in a wheelchair. And I'm like, no, you don't. He's a jerk in or out of the chair. It doesn't matter, you know.
So
And that's what I
much.
think that the industry should be clear about. And
Yeah.
Danny Murphy is a prime example of somebody who could do that, right? Because he could play this sort of jerky character,
Yeah.
and you know, lay on the guilt trip. And he was a great advocate, and the Farrelly brothers were smart to give him that platform that he actually demanded, you know.
So let's talk about how we met and your advocacy. We met several years ago at Real Abilities in New York, where I am currently. How did you hear about Real Abilities and talk about the project you were working on at that time with your partner and wife? Podfledged, I believe it's
Hot Flash.
in
Yeah.
English.
Well, I that wasn't my first time working with Real Abilities Film Festival. I've been connected to them since 2012 and have, sort of done what I could to bring attention to it using any amount of my fame or visibility factor. I've been connected to Real Abilities, low these t 10, 11 years now. Well, really 12, this will be 12 seasons. And when we met, I had put in, we had put in my wife's and my project, the Hot Flash, The Chronicles of Laura Tate, Menopausal Superhero. It was a project that she had worked on, but it was also one that, she understood too that menopause itself can be debilitating in many regards for women. It shifts their lives physically a lot. And so that was sort of the premise behind getting this into the festival. We had at least three performers, including myself, that lived with disability, for four probably, that lived with disability. While they weren't necessarily apparent disabilities, they still were in that program. And while disability wasn't necessarily the direct focus, it was there, under the surface, which is something we have to think about when we think about non-apparent disability or things that aren't necessarily recognized as disability a lot of times. Certainly, endometriosis that some women live with, it's not necessarily recognized as a disability a lot of times, even though it is. The things that can go on in a woman when she has menopause. There's a number of joint or organ disabilities that exist that people are unaware of. Depression oftentimes doesn't get recognized as a disability. And even from our own community, we can stigmatize depression as a, if I can go through this life like this, certainly you can make some changes in your life so you're not depressed. We sort of put the onus of curing a lot of times on the person with the disability, right? And we expect that to be their goal, right? So if somebody is a C4, C5 quadriplegic, there is expectation that, well, maybe one day you'll walk, or maybe one day you'll do this, or and it's this ableist desire to cure, as opposed to accept and welcome in this person regardless of your perception or the stigma that you put on them regarding their disability. And that stigma is what's led to healthcare not being equal for our community. It's led to the employment and education institutions not providing equal access to our community. So the stigma exists no matter what. And the goal is to erase those stigmas. And we've always talked about this, that the best way to do it is to show it. And the best way to show it is on the big and small screen. So that is why this is such an important avenue of advocacy.
Can you talk about how you met your wife and how, no way to avoid not getting personal, how she reacted to your disability?
I don't think she ever really took it into consideration, to be honest.
That's great to know. That's great to
It's never,
know.
I mean, it was like never anything that we discussed at the start of our relationship at all. Now that I think about it, it's not anything we ever spoke of.
That's how it should be.
We met at a comedy club, but we didn't have to speak about it because others spoke about it for us. That was the thing too. We met at a comedy club. We were both, getting into stand-up comedy, and but I know that when we first started to get together, we went to meet a friend of hers, a quote unquote friend of hers, and that friend took her aside and said, "You didn't tell me you were bringing a midget." And she was like, "What?" She was like, "What?" She's like, "First of all, why would I warn you about this? And what is the problem?" That was her reaction. And then I had, some of my own friends, people that I knew, more acquaintances, people that I knew from the comedy club circuit, the moment they saw that Amy would go out with me, they were interested in her, thinking, well, if she likes this guy, certainly she'll like me. I'm a much better package than this guy, And so there was a lot of that that went on in our life. But that was the only time it ever became an issue, is when other people's perception or judgment tried to influence.
So, you talked about mental health as a actor. Thank you for your candor, by the way. That's very important. You
It's
talked
like,
about.
Keith, if you met a girl and she was going to be with you, and this ideal of a male mate, who are the three tall, dark, and handsome, right? The ideal male mate steps in. And it's like, well, you're with this guy.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you be with me? You're with this guy. I mean, look at
Yeah.
him. He's that, and I'm this, And it's that kind of perception around disability that exists.
Oh, yes. And that's totally the point I was hoping you would get to. It's often others' perception outside of the relationship and not our partners that is the most problematic
Right.
and that can cause the most havoc, but thankfully it didn't. You talked about mental health and being an actor and following up on my last question. Because of your advocacy, do you find there's a correlation between masculinity, disability, and acting?
Definitely, for people with dwarfism, there's definitely a correlation with regard to masculinity. I've done roles. I did a role once, or I was offered a role once, where two examples. One example is a show called Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. It was a Disney show, and the character that was offered to me was he was a circus performer, a little person, but throughout the show, he is constantly like trying to put the come on to the daughter character in the show, who is like 16. And I was like, this is creepy because my character is a man in his, let's say, 40s, late 30s, early 40s, and she's a child who's 16, and I'm like making kissy faces and trying to kiss her. And that was the role. And I said, this is you this is a comedy show, and you're looking to cast me as a pedophile, but you think that's funny. And my thought was, this is a man. This is a man. But they didn't see the dwarf character as a man. They saw his some other thing. And a lot of times with regard to dwarfism and masculinity, that's the thing. You become this other. You're a clown or an animal. or something that is non-threatening, right? And I'm like, I as a man, I am threatening. And I know that if, as a man, I did anything like that with someone's daughter of 16, the mother or father would probably smash me on the head with a chair. You know, they would never stand for such a gross violation of their daughter's space. So I protested, and they did not change it, and they just gave the role to somebody else. And I never watched that episode, gratefully. And on the other end of the spectrum, I had a character on this like late night cable, like jiggle show, as they used to call them, called Silk Stockings. And it was on in the 90s. And my character was this guy who was committing murders because of this woman that he wanted to be with, but she didn't accept him because he was small. And it became about his own like sad pathos around being small. And I'm like, I don't know of any little people that live their lives with that focus, that I'm so pathetic because I'm tiny. Cause it's like, it's not like this all of a sudden happened. This is what we've lived our whole lives with, and that's who we are. And so we're not always going, I wish I was taller, I wish I was taller, I wish I was taller. We're just living our lives. And to make this guy commit murder because he's small just did not ring true to me. And so I gave some notes to the writers, and I asked them, you know, can we make it about the fact that his wife is just cheating on him? And he's a husband whose wife has cheated on him. And he's the one that's being cuckolded, but not because nothing to do with his size. And so they sort of rewrote all of it. And, you know, I didn't give the I'm a sad little man speech at the end. I gave the, you know, my wife is crazy and she's cheating on me and I can't bear it. You know, that was the impetus around the story. And then after reading the script, you could go, anybody could have played this role. It could have been played by any man of any size or stature or whatever. And so that's where I feel like I have a win, where I could change the role so that it could be played by anybody, but I just happen to be the guy doing it, you know. And there was some very sort of provocative scenes in that between her and I that didn't exist before. I kind of acted like her butler throughout the show, but I'm really her husband. It's a very sort of strange, you know, kind of relationship they had, but obviously dysfunctional, and obviously led to him killing people. So I saw that as a win because I created a very, you know, with these writers, a very nuanced character, you know, in albeit this, you know, campy cable show, you know.
So visibility for disability actors, performers, directors have certainly expanded since you got your start, and since the actors who came before you. How could it be better? What is still the shortcomings that need to be, you'd see how I'm really, really parched in that.
Oh, sure. Ask me about the shortcomings. I see. Okay, Keith. Well, I'll tell you, it's still the stigma on around disability is still very prevalent. And so producers have a fear that they have fear of litigation, or they have fear that they can't accommodate, regardless of the fact that it's the law, they have to accommodate, you know, in the workspace, you know, they have to do it. And the best way to sort of get past all of this is through engagement, you know. So if we're engaging, if the disability community has an opportunity to engage with the employers, then we can shift the paradigm of understanding. And that's been kind of my goal in working with the studios, to talk to them about about making for a more accessible space and understanding that it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to engage with the employee, the potential employee with a disability, and ask them, you know, we say, start with this question in mind. What do you need? Like if an employer were to ask, what do you need to do the best job that you can do? Right. So if we start with, it's a simple question you can ask anybody. You can't get caught on, they're asking me about my disability or anything like that. You can't get caught litigated. You know, you can't be sued for asking these kinds of questions. So these are ways in which we can have employers communicate with the disability community, and then have them understand language, right? Have them understand, you know, these are like red light words, you know. You don't want to use this kind of language. You do want to use this kind of language. You know, it all comes down to like people first or identity first. What's the best thing? People don't know. And it's like, well, you got to ask. You got to ask each individual person. Some people might be okay being called a dwarf, and some people might not be okay being called a dwarf. They might prefer a little person.
Yeah.
So I think it's just about making sure you engage with the potential employee. That's important. And language is important. And understanding that accommodations can be made. You can go the distance and figure out what those things are, and coming up with creative ideas. Like I said, if I can be a martial arts rat teacher on screen, I can look like a rat and do martial arts, then we can work out ways in which characters with disability can appear on screen and accommodate, you know, physical space or accommodate disability needs. If we can do that in this industry, we can certainly do the other, which to my mind is a very much smaller thing. It's a much smaller thing than it is to have me be a rat on screen for 2 hours. So that's part of it. And it comes back to me talking about, you know, whenever they cast a character who becomes disabled later in a film, you know, we're always willing to like green screen or CGI, like say someone has limb difference, they had a double amputee, we can always, like in the case of Forrest Gump, take off the legs, right? But why can't we do the reverse? Why can't we have somebody who is not necessarily fully able to walk or is a completely able-bodied person, have that character be a disabled person playing that role, and then when they become a disabled character, then their natural features come forth. Whereas before, we were able to have them, you know, walking around doing things that they were doing prior to the disability, right? So we can flip the switch on that, and we don't have to keep using that as the excuse. This is why we gave it to an able-bodied actor, is because part of the film he's able-bodied and part of the film he's not. Well, if you can do the special effects to make him disabled, you can also do the special effects to make that disabled performer able-bodied, you know? So there's all of those elements are doable. It's just about choices. And it also comes down to the disabilities community, as I said earlier, their access to education and opportunity is not equal to performers in this industry. So when I learned my craft, I learned it on the stage. When we go to the theater, you know, there may be ADA seating, but is the backstage ADA compliant? Are let's say wheelchair users able to get on off the stage backstage? Are they able to get to and from their dressing room? Are they able to do all of these things rather than just come and see the show? And so that's what I mean by they don't have equal access. And without that equal access to the education, they're not going to reach the level of fame that allows them to be an A-list, that allows them to be a marquee name on the screen, as was the case of Bryan Cranston doing The Upside. And he and I met and talked about that, and I talked about this very thing with regard to access to education and access to representation and opportunity. We're never going to be a Bryan Cranston unless we have all of that on an equal level. So I said to him, we need to have a thing where if you are in person in power and you take a job away from a person with disability, you have to give back three. So you took one speaking role, give back three speaking roles to disabled performers. And I call this the Woodburn ratio. So for every one you take away, you got to give back three.
So, yeah, I remembered seeing the upside and being concerned about that very thing that you were just talking about, taking
yeah,
away.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, on his behalf, you know, this deal came about for him, you know, I think probably 8 years prior to the actual filming. And so he was already sort of locked in. You know, so people don't know the whole story about why he got the role or how he got the role or any of that. And so what was going on 8 years prior to him doing that is not what's going on now, not even within our community was it going on. And so 2016, during the Oscars So White campaign, disability was very prominently left out of that discussion and purposely left out of that discussion by the Motion Picture Academy. I mean, when I say purposely, I mean, we asked to be part of it and the answer was no. So that's a very blatant disregard of our community at a leadership level during a time when it should have been part of that discussion. So, and I will always continue that, tell that story because I find it so remarkable. But 2016, that campaign sparked a movement far greater than it had been in the disability community. And so with that, with the rollover of that advocacy, there's been a bigger push. And so that the shift for me, in my mind, in my career, has only been happening for the last 5 years. Because prior to that, we talked to her blue in the face and really nothing was done.
So, good to wrap up, and thank you so much for your time. If, in case there are any aspiring advocates or actors who want to get in to either the profession of acting or advocacy, or really both at the same time, what are a few action steps you can offer them as they embark on this journey?
Yeah, action steps for somebody who wants to get in this business, either as a performer, as an advocate, or both, right? That's
yes.
Okay, so I think that the most important thing, too, is to educate yourself, right? So do what you can to get the training you can. Find the avenues for training. Find opportunities that are out there, like Disability Film Festival, you know, East Seals Disability Film Festival, the ADA Lead On. There are ways to connect to folks that have already been in the business and can maybe give you some help, guidance. So look for the resources that are out there. Keely Wells has an agency that works with disabled clients, a talent agency. KMR is another talent agency that has a huge stable of clients with disability. And so they're out there. Try to connect with these folks and see who the casting people are that are open. Danielle Pressfelter, for example, is a casting director who is very open about engaging with this community and works hard to ensure that, you know, she presents such opportunities for this community. But also try to find out who the advocates are. See what the messaging is. It's important to be on the same page with the messaging, to not be 5 years behind. You know, I see people coming into this realm a lot, and they're talking about stuff we've already covered, and they're not up to speed on what's happening today. So, you know, engage with this community and find out what the rhetoric is, what the engagement is, what our community is talking about with regard to this subject. And you know, a lot of times people come in with an angry perspective and they sort of want to attack. And sometimes they're attacking people that are already on the right side of the movement. And if they're not aware who's on the right side, then they will be attacking the wrong people. So don't just assume nobody is doing anything for the disabled community, because that's just not true. So you have to make sure that you figure out what the message is, who the allies are, and how to get on the right side of the messaging, and how to engage with the allies versus how to go after those who aren't allies.
So we've talked about a lot of topics in this episode, and again, I want to thank you for your candor and your time. I hope that both people with disabilities and people who have yet to discover their own disabilities listen to this podcast. As my guests, what do you hope that listeners with disabilities take away from this episode? And what do you hope that listeners who have yet to embrace their own disabilities take away from this episode?
Hopefully that people with disabilities don't feed themselves the tropes that exist or the stigma that exists out there about them. That they don't hold on to that as their identity, that they're more than just what others might perceive them to be. Hopefully that's a message. And for those, and I guess you mean people with non-apparent disability that are out there?
Non-apparent
or
having
discovered
or having discovered or become disabled themselves.
Well, I would think that they would recognize their importance in the discussion as allies, and recognize that, you know, your life changes with one, can change with one accident, one event, one illness, you know, your life can change. And having a deeper understanding of this community, I think, helps reduce a person's fear. You know, and I think what the disability community offers is a whole different level of diversity that is not readily understood or accepted. And so I think that's important too for people without disabilities or people who maybe don't recognize their disability as a disability. I think it's important to not be afraid to use the word, to not let the word disability exist for you the way it's existed for the non-disabled community for centuries. You know, it doesn't mean the same thing anymore. It doesn't mean less than. You know, it's an identity that our community has embraced. So we don't need to say things like differently abled or diffability. We don't need to say those kinds of words. They're more insulting than anything else because it strips us of our identity or control of our identity.
There are so many more questions I could ask you, Daniel, and I do hope you will come back because you are such a joy to talk to. I knew of you before I was even aware. I knew you. I had seen the show, as I told you, when we first met, and just not been aware that I knew your work before I met you. And
right.
So I thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Keith.
And I do hope You will come back. You always are welcome on this platform. And thank you for your advocacy and what you do for the movement, whether it be through acting, through your nonprofit, the Mulberry Group, which we didn't talk about, acting with your wife. And I just have so much respect for your entire career, and I sincerely hope you will stay in touch and feel free to come back whenever you want.
Yeah, well, next time you do a show on trapeze artists, let me know. I'll be there.
I can't really, even though we can see each other, I can't really tell if you're joking or not.
I'm joking.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you for your time. And the next time you're in the city, please look me up.
Okay, buddy.
And I always appreciate the camaraderie and the way that you look out and give back to the community. It's very encouraging. Have a great rest of your weekend, my friend.
You too.
Take care. Bye.
See ya.
You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guest, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, subscribe, and share the podcasts. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2023.